following program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now presented by Little John Financial Services. It's David Little John with True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, it is that time of the week. It is time for the True Wealth Radio Show on this Tuesday. You have. I am your host, Dave Little John, in studio with me today,
Matt Dixon.
And Matt,
yep.
We are talking about blind spots.
Yeah. That's why we buy new cars with all the fancy technology so that you don't
even need a turn signal.
Right.
Right? You just turn and hope for the best.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it's kind of wild to have. I had rented a car and I was using the backup camera, but I was getting very close to what I was backing up to and it got angry and it applied the brakes for me.
Isn't it nice?
Well, except for the part where I was doing it on purpose.
It's like, gosh dang it, I can't hit anything. What's the fun in this?
Right. Look, I bought the insurance. Just let me go. No, we're stopping. We're protecting the vehicle. Fine.
Yeah.
I think blind spots, it's actually funny that's where your mind went, because, of course, there's all these sensors that are designed because when we drive, sure enough, there are things that we cannot see.
Is hiring a financial advisor kind of like buying one of these new fancy cars that has all the tech in it? And it's like, I'm going to monitor all your blind spots and make sure you don't run off of a bridge or get smashed by a semi-truck merging lanes.
The snarky side of me says it depends on the advisor.
True.
It should be.
Right.
Right. It ought to be, but it isn't always.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because I would say, let's make sure. Are you hiring an advisor or are you hiring a salesperson?
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Ooh, solid burn there. Right. It is possible to be both, but one needs to keep in mind the golden rule of be a fiduciary. Right. The F word. So.
No, I think in all seriousness, though, there are a lot of blind spots that investors have.
Yeah.
Where
Oh, yeah.
They're actually really trying to do the best possible job that they can in investing their money, and they get caught up in some, you know, strategies or lack thereof, where you're just making mistakes and it's costing you over a long period of time.
Yeah, I might go so far as to say, in terms of maybe we define it. You know, what do we mean by blind spot? And I think we're actually throwing a, you know, it's a pretty broad term the way we're trying to apply it here, because blind spots could be things you don't see. They could also be things that maybe your perception of it is incomplete or misguided.
Yeah. I think one of the big ones that a lot of investors have a blind spot in is just thinking that they're really diversified when they're not, right? I've seen people, you know, hand me a piece of paper and it's like, check out my portfolio. And you start looking at it and maybe using some software to analyze all the holdings. And then you're like, well, basically, you just own the index. And they're like, what index? Well, you basically own the S&P 500. But I have like 40 funds, Matt. And I'm like, yeah, but they're all kind of a proxy for the S&P 500. So you own the S&P. And they're like, well, what's in that? And then you show them a map and you're like, well, about 20% of it is these five companies.
Yeah.
And they're like, wait, what? And they're like, so roughly 20% of my money is in Google, you know, NVIDIA, Microsoft, Apple, and then like, what? And they just don't know, right? Because they don't know what's behind the curtain. So I think that's one of the big ones that I've seen.
Here, I want to add to that for a second. You know, I think it's not really on our list, but there's a blind spot around how people even measure the market. Mm. I can't tell you how many times I've heard people reference the Dow as a measure of the market. And I shrug my shoulders and think, well, we've really been trained to look at that, but it's 30 stocks.
Mm-hmm.
And they're industry representatives and the biggest this or that or the other thing. And I still look at that and say, so you're telling me that 30 stocks is a proxy for the entire economy? And I just think to myself, huh, because the industry leader is not necessarily a proxy for the industry.
Right.
And yet that's become fairly acceptable in most consumer ecosystems anyway. I can't tell you how many times. And here's the other one, that it's the blind spot of not really having a sense of what the value of it is anymore. People just throw out numbers. Oh, you know, the Dow fell 300 points today. That's pretty bad, right?
Yeah.
You know, what's the value of the Dow?
Mm-hmm.
And so when we look at it and say, okay, well, you know, the Dow today, so, well, the Dow is over 46,000 right now. It fell 498 points today, okay, and it was under 500 points. Mm-hmm. So, but that's barely 1%.
Right.
That's the issue. And so, well, it's still 1%. Okay, yeah, right. The 1% is the thing that matters to us, though. 500 points. Now, 20 years ago, if the Dow fell 500 points, people would be having kittens.
Mm-hmm.
But when it falls 500 points today, you go, well, relativistically speaking, it's not nearly as many. It's not as big of a percentage today as it used to be.
Yeah.
So anyway, that to me is really interesting that we've trained people to look at that so much and to then sort of assign a grade of economic health to the marketplace based on that number. And I think that's maybe an incomplete look at things.
Yeah. And, you know, I start to think about things like, I'm sure you already know this, but I think on average, if you look at the market, only one or two companies typically stay in the top 10 when you look at like an index like the S&P or the Dow for like a decade, right?
Right.
Like a decade at a time. So, you know, 80% tend to fall out of being the flavor of the month, per se. And so,
or the flavor of the decade, per se.
Yeah, flavor of the decade. And so I think Apple's one that's kind of an anomaly, right? It's been big and it's stayed big for a really long time. There's a few that have.
Apple and Microsoft are the ones that really stand out to me. I think Google has stayed at the top of the heap for quite some time. But then there are others that have definitely
like AT&T.
Fallen.
Remember how big AT&T used to be?
Yes.
It was like this.
Or Intel. You know, that was a huge one for a season as well. So, yeah, it's really interesting. Exxon.
Mm-hmm.
Exxon used to be, I think, the larger. Is it Chevron or Exxon was
Exxon,
the largest company in the world by market cap. And then at some point, Apple passed them. And now a bunch of tech companies have passed them. And
now they look tiny.
they do by market capitalization. And it's really wild because if you looked at it and said, well, what does it touch in the ecosystem?
Mm-hmm.
And I would suggest oil is in a lot more things than our iPhone.
Yeah.
As much as you're carrying your iPhone around all the time, it's like oil's in everything. All the composites that you're surrounded by. It's not just gasoline or diesel in your vehicle. It's in all these composite materials and plastics and things that are making up the world around us. It's in your clothes. It's in your glasses. It's
and
everywhere.
How many high-income, you know, investors have you talked to that have been like, well, this stock made me a bunch of money and I'm just going to like keep riding the horse because it was the thing. And then you look at it and you're like, well, it doesn't appear to be the thing anymore. But there's just like this nostalgia around it, right?
Yeah, that comes with an actual sort of what we would call anchoring bias or sometimes hindsight bias. It's this idea. And when we have these biases, you got to understand this. A lot of these things get baked into behavioral finance. This idea that we are wired as human beings with certain behaviors, and they may be typical or air quotes normal behaviors, but they're not necessarily accurate. Okay, so when you look at something like you're describing, Matt, so the person has said, well, I have owned Exxon for 35 years and I've made a whole bunch of money on it. And so I'm committed to it.
Yeah.
Okay, here's the issue. There probably is a reality that's difficult. If you don't own a retirement plan, you probably have huge capital gains. And so the idea of selling it, it's like, great, I'm going to sell it, but then I have to partner with the IRS, right? They're going to take a big chunk of it. So I know that impacts the decision. However, if you were to look at that and say, is that the company that for the next 50 years is going to be the market leader? I would say difficult to discern, but seems unlikely given the current direction things are trending.
Yeah.
Will they still be around? Sure. But is that going to be the thing that investors flock to? My sense is probably not, just because the political and economic backdrop. Right? I think oil and gas companies stick around, but is it politically popular to get behind fossil fuels?
Mm-hmm.
Not really. right? We're much more concerned about, well, how do we do this cleanly and renewably and so forth? At which point, is there still a future for oil and gas? Yes. In oil particularly? Absolutely. Why? Because it goes into all these non-fuel-based things that we use. But it's changing.
Yeah.
And it may not be that same leadership that it experienced decades ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, sure. fair point. And so, yeah, our hindsight bias can really nip us if that's what we think. Is what got us here may not be what gets us to the next location.
Well, I mean, this is obviously just a wild one, but you kind of touched on it, right? Like Exxon was huge. That was the 2000s energy boom, right? And then financials were also booming at the time. And then you see the 2010s come around and tech starts dominating. What do you think? I mean, is tech just going to continue to get bigger and bigger and bigger as AI booms? Or do you think that we see it like some sort of shift where it's like, well, the next sector up is blah, blah, blah. Like, does tech just reign for the next 40, 50 years? Or do we finally see, you know, another sector start to be the big boom?
I'm going to do something I shouldn't, and I'm going to throw out a prediction that sort of addresses your question, but not directly.
Okay.
I think the answer is yes and. Is tech going to continue to lead? Yes. And I think tech as a sector is going to get bifurcated into different types of tech.
Okay.
And so you're not going to just see tech be a broad category any longer. It's going to be broken into specifics.
Like there's a semiconductor portion, like that type of thing. Yeah.
Well, I think it needs to head that direction. We've always sort of kept it very broad and categorically speaking for the S&P 500, for example. But let me use a smaller scale example. In the S&P 500, it's not a big sector, but it is a huge sector of our economy, mm-hmm. and that is real estate.
Right.
Real estate is massive when you consider residential and commercial, and then you have things like farm and other uses. So there are different types of real estate out there. We call it all real estate, but there are subcategories, and we could arguably say, well, you have commercial, residential, and non-commercial residential. If you just pick those three mega categories, you go, well, there you go. That you could subdivide real estate by sector, and that would make a lot of sense. But by cap weighting in the S&P 500, it's not that big, so we don't bother to do that. But as the tech index becomes 50% or whatever giant percentage of the S&P 500 index, it may behoove us to break it apart into, say, tech that is software-based tech, hardware-based tech. You know, even those two mega categories would be a delineation that would make sense.
Right.
And so, and then they could be further subdivided later, but even if you broke it apart, what you discover is, well, we have two different technology sectors, and we no longer have a tech sector. We have a software sector, and we have a hardware sector.
Hmm.
So that could happen. Right. And I think it's likely that that happens. I just couldn't tell you when.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So anyway, it's just but
interesting thought.
Yeah. So there you go. So a little free one on there, not necessarily a blind spot, but could create new ones, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And it does. It speaks to your larger point, which is, hey, what got us here may not be what gets us going forward. Well, tech may keep getting bigger, but which part of tech?
Right.
And hard to say.
Yeah. No kidding.
Yeah. Hey, look at the clock, dude.
Is it already
time? We're super long. All right, let's do this. We got to grab a break. I can't believe we snuck up on that. That was our blind spot, not watching the clock. We'll stick around. When we come back, we got more things. And the trick is, pretty much all of us as investors, we'll overlook these things. We got to figure it out so we cannot do that. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
But I know I saw part.
Okay, well, you need to, you should see it. Okay. All right, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show, where We're not on break anymore, Matt.
Dang.
All right. Reminder, you can get caught up on the podcast if you want to see or rather hear what you have missed. I will say we're not presently live streaming, but this will be on YouTube later. We'll get it up there for you. But speaking of not seeing and not knowing what the first segment was about, we are talking about
blind spots.
Blind spots.
Yep.
So you can, of course, grab the podcast to get caught up on segment one. What things did I miss? Well, we'll fill those blind spots in for you. But there are more not to be overlooked. And Matt, so many of us, these are normal, right?
Yeah.
We like, this is really, really typical. We see this walk into our office often. Talk to me about this next one, the safe bucket thing.
Yeah, I mean, basically the theory
first,
here.
Explain what a safe bucket is. It sounds like suspicious.
Well, so. You get in a jacket in a bubbled room and no.
Okay, he went there. Got it.
No, so safe bucket. We often talk with people when they're investing, and it's this concept of like, well, how much do you value having this portion of your money set aside in something that doesn't tend to move a whole lot, right? Like up or down. And some people, you know, might use like a bank CD, right? Like where the principal value isn't moving up and down. It's just giving you a little bit of interest each month, something like that, right?
So
that's an example.
So the safe bucket is
right.
A portion of your investment assets that are sort of set aside or put in a bucket
right.
That is safe, and then you have different buckets for different parts right. Of your strategy.
You're right. And but okay. What I think we're trying to say is sometimes people misread that and they assume that they are in something that I'm air quoting here is safe, mm-hmm. But then they check their account and they're like, what the heck? I'm down 20%. I thought that thing wouldn't move, right? And I think a perfect example of that was like those long-term bond funds that historically had been pretty flat and just paid a little bit of interest.
Mm-hmm.
You go back to like 2022 when they started messing with the rates, and even into 2023, some of those bond funds dropped like 40%. And so you thought maybe this applies to you, maybe not, but you might have been one of those investors that's like, hey, you know, I got a bunch of money in my bond fund. That's going to be fine. The stocks are where all the risk is. And then you wake up one day and you check your account and you're like, what the heck just happened? My stocks are up 20%, but my bonds are down 30 or something. And you're like, this isn't what I expected it to be.
Sure. And I think you're talking about something that's pretty radical. Bonds wouldn't move that much. Typically, however,
right.
You know, there
unless
are
unless the rates start to get messed with
it, and it would still take a catastrophic amount. Like you usually what you need is a series of defaults in a bond fund. You know, a lot of folks miss this, but bond funds do not offer the kind of principal protection that you would get if you owned bonds directly, because
right.
you don't get to choose whether or not to just own the bond until it matures,
mm-hmm.
right? You have an investment manager that's managing money coming in or out of those funds, and they have to then be strategic about what they are buying or selling inside of that fund. So you don't get the benefit of locking in a rate and being able to manage a bond ladder personally. You are getting
yep.
the composite outcome of a bond ladder. So that lack of a definitive end date for a bond means that you have...
Well,
you know, yeah. you can have much more fluctuation in your principal value.
Right. Well, and especially like even more than that, like the really, really long term duration ones, like where it's like 30 years out in the future, those typically, you know, get hit harder by huge changes in interest rates.
That's true. That's true.
So, I mean, I saw a stat that said that like for every like on a really long term fund, if the rates change by 1%, that can hit those long-term bond funds by like 8 to 12%.
It
just
can.
Just by a 1% move.
So
and it's like, whoa.
Think about this in your mind. Let me paint a picture for all of you listening about what this looks like. I want you to imagine that you have a teeter-totter,
mm-hmm.
right? And in the midpoint of the teeter-totter is where everything is balanced. And what you know is that at equilibrium, that teeter-totter will more or less stay level on top of that triangular tipping point in the middle. Now I want you to take that teeter-totter and move one side of it way over to the right so that the point's no longer in the middle. It's way over on the left-hand side. And what you have is this very short end of a teeter-totter and a really long end.
Right.
Now, that pivot point is the rate sensitivity. So a 1% move in the short side of your teeter-totter produces much more of a move at the long end, right? It moves a little bit on one end, but the other side goes a lot more of an extreme now because both sides aren't the same length. And that's kind of how duration works in a bond portfolio, is the longer you have until the thing matures, the more of your bond is hanging out there past the tipping point of your teeter-totter. So you get a bigger whipsaw at the end of your bond. The valuation changes more with interest. As you get the other direction, you get really close to maturity, that tipping point on your teeter-totter gets really close to the other end. And now a move on one side doesn't move very much, right? If you're kind of looking at it from left to right, if you're drawing it on a page, right?
Yeah.
That gives you a sense of the way bonds behave is, The longer the time period, the less close to the midpoint the teeter-totter is, the more exaggerated the move gets from one input on one side compared to the other.
Mm.
And that's a lot like how interest rates affect long-term bonds. So just a visual picture for you of how that behaves.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a good one. Okay, and I think if I remember right, didn't you put something up on the website like that illustrates that at one point? I think I remember that.
It is possible.
In the educational side of the website that we've got?
It's probably floating around in there. And you know what? If not, then...
We can make a video.
Yeah. We can make a video. So we'll do a blog post about it.
If you want to see it, I'm pretty sure that if you go explore the educate portion of the website, you can see like a video walkthrough of that
right.
one.
This is all about... Right. By the way, any time that you run across something where you think to yourself, self, I would like more explanation around that. Send us an email.
You can
email info@littlejohnfs.com. You can also text to 541-375-0898 and just say, hey, I got a question. And we will try to keep the Knowledge Center up to date on the webpage, and it oftentimes makes its way onto this show.
Cool. I like that.
Yeah.
So talk to me a little bit more about kind of like misreading risk. Like, what are some of the other ways that someone might be able to like... kind of make a little bit of a whoopsie on this one where they're not really like gauging fully what they're getting into or what they're holding.
Yeah. So it's funny when we're talking about that, again, the safe bucket or that portion of your account that you've set aside. A lot of folks, you may think that you have something that's safe that's not. But the funny thing is I oftentimes see people that disregard part of their portfolio. And so what they end up doing is they make their portfolio really safe, but then they are risking the long-term ability for them to compensate for inflation.
Mm.
Let me give you an example.
Okay.
One of them, almost everybody in America will end up with, but the other one, some people, they're just fortunate to. And it is, do you have a pension?
Okay.
A pension is this idea that I had a relationship with my employer such that when I finally am eligible and I leave employment, I'm going to continue to receive some form of income stream in my retirement years. That pension, the first question is it fixed? Meaning, is it going to have a cost of living adjustment or not? By the way, if you're thinking to yourself, this doesn't apply to me, it sort of does, because most of us will be eligible for Social Security.
Mm.
And Social Security walks and talks a little bit like this. And it's a great illustration of the point. See, a lot of pensions, you have the option of either selecting a lifetime payout, or you could roll that pension over and take control of it yourself. And now you have a nest egg that you're responsible for managing. And the nest egg is what is intended to then provide for your retirement.
Right.
Well, the nest egg stays in the hands of your employer, and they pay you an income stream from it. And that income stream is guaranteed by the pension. What does that sound like to you, Matt? Because to me, it sounds a little bit like if I were to purchase a bond and keep collecting a monthly income stream from it.
Okay.
Well, that is a fixed income instrument.
Right.
This is what makes Social Security fascinating. I kind of lock it in. I can't roll it over, so I'm never going to get the control of the nest egg, but it does behave a lot like a fixed income instrument.
Yes.
And so there are some advisors and money managers that would suggest you should look at the pension components of your financial resources as a form of fixed income. And then your other investments are intended to pair with, and you consider those pensions as very, very conservative investments, and then you match your other investments to it. So it's a more holistic total worth review of your investments.
Yeah.
Where a lot of people will just disregard pensions as not part of their investment
so
mix at all.
Pensions, yeah. The pension portion's a good one. I think another big piece of that is like real estate, right? Like a lot of people, they don't account for the fact that there could be not very much liquidity on their net worth.
So let's talk about, I'm looking at the clock. Yeah. Real estate's a great one for us to take a break on. I know we all, most of us are living in a house, or maybe you have rental properties too. We should talk about real estate as a component of this. It's another blind spot that shows up all the time, but we got to grab a break. So we'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon.
Okay, Matt, yes. Talking blind spots. Mm-hmm. And we just talked about the idea that people will oftentimes fail to include Social Security or other pensions,
mm-hmm.
when holistically looking at the total amount of risk they're taking in their investment strategy.
Yeah.
And then you sort of pivoted and said, oh, well, then another thing about real estate. And then I was like, Matt, this is way too interesting and important to just let you throw it in
right
at the 11th hour of the last segment.
Yeah.
I want you to have time to unpack this for our listeners. Talk to me about blind spots in real estate.
Right.
What's up there?
Yeah, you were talking about misreading some risk when it comes to evaluating your pension. I'm like, well, have you also maybe slept on your real estate holdings, right? Because a lot of people have this assumption that I'm going to buy real estate and it's just going to go up, right? And
which is funny to me, having lived through 2008, like, that assumption does not compute. But it is interesting that it still persists as a concept that mm-hmm. is out there.
Right. And then I, you know, can counter with a bunch of different things where it's like, well, you say you buy real estate. Well, now your money's not liquid. So if you need it, now you got to try and sell the real estate. And you could play a lot of different hypothetical games. Like, okay, you bought this place at 2% interest, and then 6 months later, interest rates are at 4. Do you think you're going to sell it for the same exact price? I mean, maybe, but you might not be able to sell it for as much as you bought it for. And I literally watched that happen with a house in my neighborhood. The people bought it right at the very, very peak. They put some solar panels on the roof that cost them 30, 40 grand. They thought it was an investment. And then they decided that they wanted to move. And they put it up for sale, and it's been almost a year. And the place hasn't sold. And so now they're renting it, trying not to foreclose on the house. So it's like, it's not like a foolproof idea to just think that you can park it in real estate, close your eyes, and you magically are making money. It doesn't work that way.
It doesn't. People don't recognize that when you own real estate directly like that, that you're essentially owning a business.
Yep.
You know, it's just it's a small business, but you're operating a small business at that point, and there are risks associated with small business. The other thing is, I think folks get lured into different behaviors that are actually advantageous, but they are behaviors that they're lured into perhaps with some misinformation. And you've alluded to this, but mm-hmm. I'm just calling it out.
Sure.
It's the idea that some people buy real estate and then they immediately shift to long-term thinking. They don't think about the short-term fluctuations in value because to them it's a long-term investment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because we struggle to see people adopt a similar attitude in the stock market. And I think it's because the stock market, whether you want to call it rewards you with or penalizes you with, either way, it shows you the daily moves. And so that all that action tends to get people more excited as if, well, should I do something with this information? Things are moving constantly. Do I need to do something? And oftentimes, people will, because the markets are down at some point or another, will panic and they'll start taking actions that are not going to be in their best interest long term, but it's because they get lulled into short-term thinking by a market condition where in real estate, a lot of folks, that just doesn't happen the same way, right?
Yeah.
It's long-term. I can't see the daily number of people willing to buy or sell my house at any moment. So out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah. And I don't know if this stat is true or not. So bear with me on this, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I've heard that commercial, like on the commercial side, we've been largely talking residential. On the commercial side, I've heard that valuations, since the rates went up a bunch, because remember, rates were really low for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a lot of years where money was cheap. Now, rates have gone up, and I've heard that commercial real estate is down like 15 to 20%. Now, part of that might be because of the fact that COVID hit, and now there's a lot less, like, there's a lot more working from home, and maybe
It's all of the above. I think it's the cocktail of all of those things, but I think your data is still pretty close to spot on.
So I look at that, and I'm like, well, could you have misread the risk just thinking, hey, I'll put 100% of my portfolio in real estate, and I'm good?
Well, absolutely.
Yeah. So,
and if you're wondering where does this come from, we have had investors that have come to through our organization, and that's literally what they have is, well, you know, I have my home and I have rental property.
Yeah.
And that's what my investments are.
Well, it's hard when they need a bunch of money all at once, right? Oh, you know, I don't have much in my savings account. I've got like four rentals, but I need to put a new roof on my house and new siding. I need $80,000. And then they look at their portfolio and they're like, but I don't have $80,000. I am worth a lot more than $80,000, but I have to sell a rental to go do it.
Right. Or you have to take a loan out and now you have a loan again on your rentals because that's how you got the cash out of it.
Exactly.
And keep in mind, I'm not demonizing that out of the gate. Right. There are some radio show hosts that also have the name Dave that would probably be anti that as an idea. But I'm not here to get to that level of granularity. I'm just here to say that would be one of the ways that you would get liquidity out. You're running a business now, but you're also managing debt. With debt comes other issues at play, not the least of which includes managing cash flows and servicing that debt.
Ooh.
But the taxes get more complex. Lots of things start to layer into it. So your business got a little bit more involved as soon as you had to do that to conjure liquidity. Now, if you're the person that says, no, I just take all the rents and throw them into everything's paid for and I just collect it and it stores up in a savings account. Okay. What you have is a super conservative business. And that is okay too.
Yeah.
Right. And if that's working for you, then it's less of a blind spot than an acknowledgement that, you know, this is how I'm going to do it.
Mm.
But the blind spot would be thinking that the real estate will never fluctuate in value.
I got another blind spot for you.
Hit me.
Just saying, hey, I got a huge chunk of cash and it's just going to sit there as cash. And
you mean investor that just
I have no
collects
plan.
The rents and drops them in the bank?
It's the guy that's got 200, maybe 2 million. We'll go with $2 million. I got $2 million and I'm always going to have 500,000 of it just sitting in cash uninvested because I'm fearful that I might need it. So it's just going to sit there in cash and it's never going to
probably going to be in multiple banks too, because we wouldn't want to risk the FDIC coverage.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep. But I'm okay getting 0.002% because I like having cash available. That can be a blind spot.
Well, it's one of those, or maybe somebody sees it directly. They're just saying, essentially, don't care, willing to forego the return, and because I just want it to be there, it's like a security blanket, and that's how I sleep at night.
Like if it's earmarked for something, right, and you're going to go—
Here's the crazier one, Matt. Cash in a safe.
That's a good example.
A little bit, okay, but like I hear people that put really large numbers, like, you know, I keep $50,000, $60,000, $100,000 of cash in a safe, to which I think that's guaranteed to lose value.
Yeah. I mean, the dollar this year has already lost, what, 12% of its value?
I couldn't tell you.
Projections for next year, another 10%. Cash is buying time. It's not buying growth.
Well, yeah, I always think of cash as lighter fluid. Right, it's something that will quickly go up in flames. But it's quickly accessible. That's the real reason I call it lighter fluid. In your investment strategy, it's the dry powder. It's the ability to seize an opportunity when it shows up.
An opportunity,
but
it's only lighter fluid. It's only lighter fluid if you're
going to use it.
If you're ever going to light the match. But too many people They don't. Yeah. They're like, it's lighter fluid, but then they bury their matches or throw them in the garbage.
It's not lighter fluid. What it is it's the firewood that's uncovered that rots into a pile of mush.
That's a better analogy. I like that.
And so you're like, this could have been firewood, but it went unaddressed, and it just mushrooms got into it, and before you know it, it's just moss and mush.
And you know what the mushrooms and the moss is? It's the inflation.
Yeah.
And people don't get that, because how many times have you done a financial plan for someone, and they're like, well, I looked at my Social Security number, and then I looked at what my mortgage is, and there's surplus there, so I'll be fine indefinitely over the next 30 years. And you're like, well, what happens when food costs triple in between now and 20 years? Or what happens when your property taxes triple? Like, people don't think about that. And so then, you know, insert cash sitting uninvested for the 20, 30 years in the gun safe. That sucks.
Yes, it does. And I'm not sure that it's because people don't know. I think some people just willingly turn away from it. Well, or some people just... At the end of the day, they know, but they don't act.
You know why they do it? Because it's emotional comfort.
I think it's emotional comfort, or it's low on the priority list. And, you know, you just keep bumping it down until you realize it's been 2 years and I haven't done anything with this. And I'll tell you, 2 years at 4%, you're looking at over $8,000 if you had $100,000 sitting somewhere doing nothing.
Yep.
And that's real money. You can do something with $8,000.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So, you know, even if you had to pay taxes on it, still six for most of us, like $6,000 that's left. Like, well,
yeah. How many groceries does that buy you?
It's a pretty good chunk. It's, you know,
like if you're complaining about your groceries and your $100,000,
it's $500 a month right there.
Right.
If you were to stack it. So, yeah, it's anyway, you and I look at this and you go, ah, you know, this is it's a wasted opportunity. You know, especially because from where I sit, it's like it's a wasted opportunity because you could probably get significantly more return and no additional risk. It's literally the worst kind of investment where you go, well, so basically you get the same risk and less return.
Right.
That's not ideal.
Yeah.
All right. Heavens to Betsy. It's we're long.
Is
on
it really that time?
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
It's
all right.
Not.
We'll take. Let's do this. We're going to take the last break. Okay. We're going to do that. We're going to come back. And we're going to talk about one of the last blind spots. And I'll give you a hint. This is written all over financial materials constantly, and yet we still do it. You're warned about it all the time, and yet we still do it. If you want to know what it is, stick around. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, welcome back to the home stretch of the True Wealth Show. In our final minutes.
Are we winding down or are we winding up?
I don't know that we ever wound down, that's for sure.
Okay.
But we're gonna kind of finish strong here. We have been covering blind spots today. Blind spots that even high net worth investors have. Right. This is a typical blind spots for most investors, and it gets everybody. Right. Billionaires have these blind spots, crazy enough. So don't feel bad about it, but there are still things you can do. Matt.
Yep.
This stuff gets printed all over financial product, like any kind of advertisements. It's all over the place. Seems like this is perhaps the number one warning. And yet we still see it happen all the time.
Okay. What do you got in mind?
Past performance is no guarantee of future results.
Oh, yeah. You do see that everywhere, don't you?
Right. That is probably the number one disclosure that you see on investment literature just about anywhere.
Okay. Yeah.
For good reason, right? The past actually doesn't inform the future.
And would you say that that theory also applies to just like... how people age and like what changes in their future as far as retirement goes? Because I think that's a big one.
I feel like there is some assumption inside of that question. And I'd like to know what motivated the way you asked it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of people, right, that go into retirement and they just assume that, you know, everything that has been happening in their lives will remain static into the future, right? And so, like, a lot of people, for example, don't necessarily account for how much healthcare costs could be. Right? Like, they've been just cruising along and they had their workplace insurance plan that kind of covered stuff. And yeah, they had some deductibles and it was fine. But then they get into retirement and they're like, I need a hip replacement and I need a knee replacement and now I need dentures. I'll tell you, their healthcare's gotten expensive. And I think that the average couple retiring today is spending like $300,000 on healthcare over the course of their retired.
Oh, over their retirement lifetime?
Retirement maybe. Lifetime.
I was waiting for $300,000 a year. I'm like, I need to see that data.
Well, but, that would be a very sick person.
Over a lifetime. I mean, I can see for a couple.
Think about it.
I can see that add up.
Yeah, two people.
Just between premiums and like then the medications. Years. And yeah, it just sort of adds up. And
I mean,
then end of life stuff.
Over, I mean, two people, if they live 20 years in retirement, that's 40 combined years.
Mm-hmm.
And over 40 years, you spend $300,000. That's
not radical.
That's not even $10,000 a year.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, well, $400 or $500
a month. Interesting if that stat was time adjusted for time value of money, or if that's just a snapshot in today's dollars or what.
We know that longevity rest is like a bigger and bigger thing, right? Like, people are living longer than they ever have. Like, if someone lives to 95, is it that rare?
No.
Not really.
No.
And so it's like, oh, you retired at 62 and then you lived another 32 years, 33 years. Not crazy.
No, it's not. It's interesting that this was the take that you brought up too, because the investment literature thing is really talking about investment performance,
mm-hmm.
but it's such a valid point. And I hope all of our listeners pay attention to this, that it's what does the future hold for you? That's mm-hmm. what you have to price into your strategy.
Yeah.
When we talk about financial planning with people, we talk about what's the life that you would like to design, and then designing to that and figuring out what it's going to cost to live the life that they're trying to design, and then reverse engineering it.
Right.
But in your retirement golden years, air quotes, a lot of people forget things in the design. And that's kind of part of what you're saying too, is there's, well, did you include these things in your strategy, or were you, in a sense, willfully yeah. blind, or maybe not willfully, but the blind spot was forgetting to account for those other elements.
Right. Life changes.
Yes.
And a lot
and
of people
medical is
don't
a really
that.
Huge one.
Yeah. A lot of the times when I'm doing a financial plan, people don't think about these things. And so it's like, just like your investments are always changing, so is your life.
It's true. I think one of the big blind spots in retirement too, that's not, and it's related to this, but it's separate, but they impact each other.
Okay.
Is a lot of folks don't necessarily have a great understanding of how their retirement income is going to be taxed.
Ooh,
and
that's a good one. Yeah.
It's that there's this blind spot that's a systemic blind spot, right? Hey, we don't know how the system works. And then these things start to happen. And before you know it, they forget things like property taxes go up every year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But if you have a big enough property, they may go up on a relativistic but still percentage basis. Like, their percentage goes up, but the absolute value of it goes up more than your other fixed income instruments. And so those taxes become a bigger portion of your budget while you're simultaneously seeing a bigger portion going into healthcare. And if you do not account for that in your financial strategy, you could find that your expenses go up faster than anticipated and that you are losing relative purchasing power. So what you do is you have lifestyle degradation because you can't keep up.
Yep.
And so these are things that, yeah, they're blind spots in your plan. And why do we point these out? I don't want you to experience that. I don't want you to get into a situation where, hey, we're going to transition into retirement, but we overlooked some costs. And the result is that now our lifestyle is not what we had hoped it would be because we did not have sufficient nest eggs prepared.
Hmm.
You know, and it could have been as simple as, well, you know, we could have pushed retirement out for a year or two and all of these things would have been solved.
Yeah.
But that's not what we did.
Hmm.
So Yeah. And then the other, this one's not a blind spot, but it's a you can't predict the future. Sequence of returns risk. Right? That's one that we didn't talk about that, but I mean, do you know what I'm talking about, Matt, when I say sequence of returns risk?
Refresh my memory.
Well, this is kind of the industry name, but for all of us, just for the people out there listening, we can't predict what next year's return is going to be or the year after that or the year after that.
Okay.
Over a 20, 30-year period, we know that generally speaking, average returns and average inflation are about what they are.
Are you saying that like potentially someone could have a series of really low returns over a lot of years and then that's the risk?
No, that's more like just miscalculating your assumptions of return. I'm saying if we have two or three down years in a row out of the gate,
mm-hmm.
your nest egg could shrink. And then if you had anticipated taking a fixed amount out, the fixed amount coming out of a much smaller nest egg could be more than the nest egg's capable of sustaining.
Right.
Here's an example. Like, hey, I have $1 million and I wanted to take out $40,000 a year in returns. If I make 4%, then I'll make $40,000 a year anyway. And so I can take that amount out and then it should fill it back up to about break even. So I'll still have $1 million. But what if I go through two or three years in a row where the market loses 30%? So first, $1 million becomes $700,000, and then you lose 30% of that, and so it's down to about $500,000, and then you lose 30% of that. You're like, holy cow.
Yeah.
If you have 3 years in a row, you're unretired.
Yep.
Because those returns are – and so the sequence of returns risk is pretty high. It's also why we advocate for buckets of money and appropriate risk when you get to retirement.
I like it.
Yeah. Well, look, I know there are more blind spots, but I'm looking at the clock, and we can't let that one be one of ours.
We're not going to be here till 9 o'clock?
Not on air. So okay. We better get ready to go. How can people reach out if they would like just a second set of eyes to maybe check those blind spots that they might have?
Yeah, you can call or text us at 541-375-0898 or shoot us an email at info@littlejohnfs.com.
That's right. And again, check the rest of this out on podcast. It'll be posted tomorrow. A bunch of stuff in our Knowledge Center. You can also email if you've got questions. Initial consults are always free, so we'd love to connect with you. But we're out of time for now, so we got to run. Until next time, I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
Thanks for joining us.